This podcast was recorded at the 2017 JAD Pro Live at AppShow Conference in Houston, Texas. The title of this session is Optimizing Outcomes for Patients with Soft Tissue Sarcomas Through the Multidisciplinary Medical Oncology Radiation Surgical Team Approach. And it is presented by Leah Clark, David Johnson, and Arash Nagabi from the Sarcoma Program, Moffitt Cancer Center. To view the presentation material, see other topics of interest, and learn how to earn credit for these activities, please visit advancedpractitioner.com/sessions2017. And now, we're delighted to bring you this podcast from JAD Pro Live.
Good morning, everyone. We're going to get started. My name is Gabriel Zaysha. I'm from Seattle, Seattle Cancer Care Alliance, where I'm a PA. Our next session is a wonderful example of multidisciplinary collaborative approach entitled Optimizing Outcomes for Patients with Soft Tissue Sarcomas Through the Multidisciplinary Oncology, Radiation, and Surgical Approach. So please join me in welcoming Dave Johnson from Moffitt Cancer Center, Dr. Arash Nagabe, also from Moffitt, and Princess Leia, also known as Leah Clark from Moffitt Cancer Center. Thank you.
All right, well, good morning to everybody. I want to definitely appreciate the audience coming to listen to this, what we find a very fascinating topic to discuss this morning. I definitely want to take some time out to thank JAD Pro for inviting us, and also AppShow for inviting us as well to this conference. I know that I'm enjoying it. Hopefully you guys are enjoying it, and this will even kind of solidify that for you as we go through talking about our interesting topic today. So you guys have probably seen the learning objectives and stuff, and mainly what we want to talk about today is we do want to kind of talk about this multidisciplinary approach to treating this very rare disease of soft tissue sarcomas. And so we're going to kind of talk about surgery, we're going to talk about radiation, and we're going to talk about chemotherapy. And not only are you going to see the multidisciplinary approach, you're going to see the multi-professional approach as well. As you see, I'm here with two outstanding colleagues of mine, Leah Clark, a nurse practitioner, and Dr. Nagabi, a physician. So it does take a team to treat these patients. It's very rare disease and stuff, and we'll kind of go through that whole process. These are our financial disclosures. So let's talk about sarcomas. I don't know how many people deal with sarcomas out there, but let's kind of start basic just a little bit so we know where we're playing from, okay? So sarcomas, everything kind of comes from the Greek, okay? So sarc meaning fish-like and oma meaning tumor. So this is a fish-like tumor, or that's how they describe it. And the reason why it gets that description is when we surgically resect it, it does look like that. It kind of looks like kind of raw fish, so to speak. The tissue doesn't look like its normal process that we see in the human body and stuff, so it comes up with that type of name. They are transformed cells from mesenchymal origin, okay? They get their name from their point of origin. So if you have the sarcoma starting in bone, you have an osteosarcoma. If you have a sarcoma starting in fat, your fatty tissue, it's a liposarcoma. If it's on the vascular side, hemangioendothelioma, okay? So that's how we kind of derive the names. So soft tissue sarcomas are extremely rare, okay? As you see, benign neoplasms from mesenchymal origin, about 100 times more likely to have than a malignant soft tissue sarcoma. You can have sarcomas, as we already mentioned, that originate in the bone, which make up a smaller percentage of the sarcomas. A larger percentage are really made up of from your soft tissues that we kind of went over earlier. But these are very rare diseases. You can see the statistics in 2015. We had about 11,000, almost 12,000 new cases of soft tissue sarcoma diagnosed. Put that into perspective. In the United States alone, breast cancers in that year, about 250,000. Okay, so it just kind of really kind of depicts exactly how rare this disease is. It is rare, however, it does make up about 1% of all cancer deaths. So we had about, in 2015, we had cancer deaths of approximately 5,000. In 2016, not a whole lot of difference, okay? We had actually a little bit increase in the numbers, about 12,000 new cases of soft tissue sarcomas and approximately 5,000 deaths, okay? You can see by the pictorial that you have about a 1 in 100,000 chance of getting a soft tissue sarcoma in somebody 20 years or older. As we get older, greater than 20 years, you got about a 7 in 100,000 chance of getting a soft tissue sarcoma. So extremely rare. Male to female ratio, pretty close, 1.2 to males, 1 to females and stuff. This is mainly a disease that we see prevalence more as we get into our older decades of life, 60, 70, 80, and sometimes even 90-year-olds, okay? They come in different sizes and shapes. They can be in your extremities. They can be in your trunk. They can be in your neck, okay? They can be in your retroperitoneum. They can be pretty much anywhere in your body and stuff. So when we have a soft tissue sarcoma or we have a, I should say, a soft tissue mass that presents on a patient, we need to be working it up appropriately and have this awareness that not everything is benign. Even though we talked about 100 times more benign mesenchymal origin cells, but we can't have these malignant cells as well. So we need to be aware of this. In fact, if you look at the delay in diagnosis on soft tissue sarcoma is anywhere from about 3 to 6 months. And we all know the quicker we can treat a cancer, the better outcomes we can have and stuff. So we need to have this awareness about these disease processes. Now, with the advent of the human genome being depicted, we have been able to find out different mutations in that genome that actually transform into certain soft tissue sarcomas. And this has been very revolutionary for us in the way we treat our diseases now, particularly systemically with our chemotherapies. And Leah will kind of talk more about this in the future and stuff. But if you went to the genomics lecture earlier, I think it was yesterday and stuff, did a phenomenal job about talking about mutations in cells and how the body tries to make that better. But if they can't, basically these cells can transform it into further getting into your soft tissue sarcoma development. So let's talk about workup first. So when we have somebody with a soft tissue mass that presents to us, okay, we want to be aware. We want to not just slough it off and say, oh, that's a lipoma. Okay, we want to definitely work it up. We need to consider the age. We need to consider the location. We need to consider, you know, what is the functionality loss with that patient? If it isn't an extremity, okay, do they have any type of functionality loss? Talk about the skin. What does the overlying skin look like? History is very important. Not just for soft tissue sarcomas, but for any of the cancers that we deal with out there. So history, very, very important. The next thing I would talk about would be imaging. Okay, imaging is very important, okay? X-ray, CT, MRI scan. It's going to help us determine whether or not this looks more malignant or more benign. So imaging is very key. But our gold standard to make the diagnosis is really biopsy. Okay, and this is where the multi-D approach comes into place. You need to have a dedicated musculoskeletal radiologist to go over that radiology. You need to have a dedicated pathologist that specializes hopefully in soft tissue sarcomas because these are very difficult histological and radiographic diagnoses to make on imaging and also pathology. But our gold standard is really biopsy, and this is very key. We'll talk about staging in just a little bit. So here's an interesting thing. So when we talk about the approach to working these patients up and stuff, we already talked about age, their symptomatology, where it's located at. Remember, age is very important. If I got somebody that's a teenager or something with a soft tissue mass, I'm not thinking malignancy right off the get-go. But if I got somebody that's 60, 70, 80 years old that has a soft tissue mass, certainly that becomes higher up on my differential. So age is very important. Radiographs are very important. Okay, so plain film x-rays. Plain film x-rays can give us a lot of detail about what that mass is doing. And sometimes people will say, well, Dave, we get plain film x-rays for bone. Okay, we don't really look at soft tissues in plain film x-rays. But remember, we can see soft tissues in the plain film x-rays. Plain film x-rays are relatively inexpensive to get. We all have access to plain film x-rays, so we want to go ahead and get that. We can see density with the soft tissue mass. We can see mineralization. And because of density and mineralization in those plain film x-rays, we can kind of develop our differential and kind of see whether or not does this look bad or not so bad to us. CT scans. We do get CT scans occasionally, okay? Sometimes somebody needs to get a CT scan. They got shrapnel in their body. They got a pacemaker. They got a defibrillator. They can't get an MRI for whatever reason, and they get CT scans. And this is a really great pictorial here where you see this soft tissue mass on the lateral aspect of somebody's thigh. This is where your multidisciplinary team comes into play because you have your musculoskeletal radiologist kind of telling you from a CT scan, yeah, this is a heterogeneic mass. It's pretty big. It's got a lot of different densities into it and stuff like that. biopsy with your musculoskeletal radiologist is very important because, you know, we need to get the yield that we want. So if we biopsy this area right here in the center, we're going to get normal fat. Okay? Does that give us a lot of information? Okay, it actually tells somebody that if they do biopsy that area, it's a benign tumor. Okay? This is a little bit more intermediate grade, more higher grade. This is where our money's at right here. We want to talk with our musculoskeletal radiologist. This is where we want to do the biopsy. It gives us the highest yield for making that diagnosis. So multi-D approach here. And then also getting with your pathologist to go over that radiology as well with your presumptive diagnoses. MRI scan is really our kind of gold standard here when we look at imaging. Okay, so with soft tissue sarcomas, on MRI scans, usually the masses are about 4 centimeters or greater, okay? They are dark on T1, bright on stir signal, and bright on contrast, okay? They're heterogeneic, okay? They got a lot of different densities in those soft tissue masses. There's some necrosis sometimes with it, okay? They have a pseudocapsule, so you can kind of trace your finger around this and say that's exactly where the mass is. You can see the heterogeneity of the mass. You can see the tissue necrosis here and stuff like that as well. Peritumoral edema, you're going to see on a stir-weighted image. So here's your T1, here's your stir-weighted image, and here's your contrast-enhanced image. You can look at it on axial, you can look at it on sagittal, you can look at it on coronal planes. It doesn't matter, okay? But make sure you get those three images up. T1, stir, and your contrast enhanced image. Very, very important to make this diagnosis. So here you can see on the stir-weighted image, which is our water-weighted image, now that same mass that we saw on the previous slide here, you can kind of see where that peritumoral edema is here, right here and some up right here, both proximally and distally. This is very important to work with your musculoskeletal radiologist because from a surgical standpoint, this is important to know where that peritumoral edema is, and it kind of depicts what type of resection that we're going to be doing. So soft tissue sarcoma's outlook, okay? Poor prognosis, somebody that's older, somebody that's greater than 60 years old, okay? Somebody that has a higher grade tumor, a larger tumor, and sometimes even they've already been excised someplace else and they present with positive margins. These are all significant for poorer prognosis. So when we talk about soft tissue sarcomas, I already told you that there's about 12,000 diagnosed every year, okay? There are over 70 different subtypes of soft tissue sarcomas, 70 different, and they all are treated just a little bit differently. That's what makes it so challenging to treat this disease, and that's why you need the multi-team approach. You can see out of the 12,000, only 27% make up the most popular or most prevalent soft tissue sarcoma, which is your undifferentiated high-grade sarcoma, followed by liposarcoma, and then finally leiomyosarcoma. So let's talk about size with these tumors. Size does matter with soft tissue sarcomas. You can see the 5-year survival rate here. This is taking all comers, all histological subtypes, okay, all grades, okay? This is just totally looking at size. So if you have a tumor that's less than 5 centimeters, 75% chance of a 5-year survival, and you can see where the pictorial brings you down as you get a higher type of tumor as far as size goes. All right, let's look at grade. Grade is very important as well. Remember, we have 3 grades when we deal with soft tissue sarcomas. We have low grade, we have intermediate grade, and we have high grade. High grade being a more aggressive tumor. So this is taking all comers. This is taking all sizes, all histological subtypes, just looking at grade as being a predictive value for overall survival, as you can see there. Okay. So let's talk about stage for a little bit as well. So we do stage these tumors, okay? So we got stage 1, 2, 3, and 4. Okay, our stage 1 tumors are typically our lower grade, less than 5 centimeter tumors. These are low grade, less than 5 centimeter tumors. Stage 2, these are our intermediate, the higher grade tumors, still maybe around 5 centimeters, okay? Could be a little bit over, a little bit above 5 centimeters. They're more superficial type of tumors, and they're more in your distal portion of your extremities, okay, the distal portion of your extremities. Grade 3, still intermediate and high grade, but now your tumors are getting a little bit bigger. They're getting greater than 5 centimeters, okay, and now they're more deep in your soft tissue than they're more in the proximate portions of your extremities and also into your retroperitoneum, okay, and then stage 4 obviously would be your metastatic disease, okay? So here's your survival rate with taking all state, looking at the stages and stuff. And it makes sense as we see down here, as we get into our stage 2 and 3s, our 3s and 4s, we're definitely using modalities like radiation and chemotherapy, even in stage 2, radiation and chemotherapy as well, OK? okay, our multidisciplinary approach. Where do these things metastasize to? Particularly the chest, okay? They particularly metastasize to the chest. Now, when I have somebody with a newly diagnosed soft tissue sarcoma, I'm gonna get a CT scan of the chest, abdomen, and pelvis, just to be thorough. I might have a histological diagnosis and stuff, but I haven't removed the entire tumor, and sometimes we all know that our diagnosis has changed. So I always start off with a CT scan of the chest, abdomen, and pelvis just to rule out metastatic disease. But once I finally get that tumor out and I have a definitive diagnosis, I might just go to a CT scan of the chest. The ones you need a CT scan of the chest, abdomen, and pelvis are the myxoid liposarcomas, the synovial sarcomas, the rhabdomyosarcomas, and the angiosarcomas. Lymph node metastasis can occur as well, so we need to be aware of that. So lymph node metastasis needs to be looked at for some of our tumors. And we use a mnemonic RACES, okay? So RACES is rhabdomyosarcoma, alveolar, angiosarcoma, clear cell sarcoma, epithelioid, and synovial sarcomas, where we need to be looking at those lymph nodes. So the multimodal approach, okay? Surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy. Surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy. All right, so with surgery and radiation, we're talking about local control, okay? So we can take the tumor out, hopefully we can get it under local control, we can use radiation, sometimes we use radiation in conjunction with surgery, sometimes we use it as its own entity, okay? We'll kind of go over that further as the talk goes on. Low-grade sarcomas, take the tumor out. This is a lower-grade tumor, usually less than 5 centimeters, sometimes it can go up to 6 or 7 centimeters. We remove those. We rarely use any type of adjunctive radiation or chemotherapy. We may, in some instances, if the tumor is like greater than 10 centimeters, or if this is a recurrent tumor in the surgical bed, or if removing the tumor was going to cause a patient a lot of functional loss, or they might have a positive margin from a previous resection. Most of the time, we just take these out. Let's focus on our high-grade tumors, our high-grade soft tissue tumors, okay? So limb-sparing surgery is the key word here, okay? We really try to limb spare the surgery with extremity soft tissue sarcomas to not only remove the cancer, but to provide the patient the best functionality as possible, okay? And this is important for our patients. So let's talk about surgical margins a little bit. So these soft tissue sarcomas grow from an epicenter, and they get bigger and bigger and bigger as time goes on, and they push everything away from it. Remember, it's got a pseudocapsule, but also remember that it's also got that peritumoral edema, which is important because that's your reactive zone. Your reactive zone is where you can have microscopic disease that you can't pick up on your imaging and stuff. You need to be aware of that as a surgeon, so when you go in, you do the appropriate surgery. The appropriate surgery for soft tissue sarcomas is from, there needs to be one normal cell between that surgeon and that tumor. That's a good margin, okay, one cell. It's not like melanoma where you have to have 2 centimeters and stuff like that. It's different, okay? So you need one cell. So you need to be aware of this reactive zone and these satellite lesions and stuff. Now, there's other type of resections that you can do. You can certainly do, you know, like a radical resection, remove the entire compartment, do a very wide resection, removing normal tissue and stuff. But here again, you translate that with a greater toxicity to the patient and a greater functional limb loss. And that's not what we're trying to accomplish here, okay? We don't need to accomplish that. So this is just an example of a wide resection, okay? You can see a normal tissue, normal muscle tissue, cuff of muscle around this tumor. It's in between our fingers there and stuff, and that's typically what we do in our surgeries, okay? With surgical margins, okay, if we go back to that pictorial, obviously if we do a surgical resection and we're intralesional, we got 100% chance of local recurrence, okay? If we do like a marginal resection, 30% chance, a marginal resection, 70% chance. A wide resection is about a 30% chance, and then a radical and an amputation, about 5%. Okay, so we need to be thinking about what type of surgery we need to do. This is where we think we want to be at, radical or amputation, but remember, that is a high toxicity to the patient. It has a high functional limb loss with the patient and stuff. So can we do something to improve those numbers? Here's some data back here that you can see that kind of goes with, you know, the local recurrence on a marginal resection versus a wide resection versus a radical or an amputation type of surgery for these tumors and stuff. I like to follow Anakin's data. I'm from the University of Florida, and Anakin's from the University of Florida. I like to follow his data. You can see about a 4% chance of local recurrence with a radical resection, 25% maybe with a wide resection, and finally a marginal resection around 50 or 60%. So this is the money here, okay, money slide. So we know we have a 30% chance of local local recurrence by doing a marginal resection, okay? A marginal resection, we have about 30% chance of local recurrence. Remember, because we're probably going to be in that reactive zone where there's microscopic disease that we can't see, okay, very well on imaging. We may be able to see it a little bit well better in surgery. We sometimes can see that edema and stuff. This is where we work very closely with our radiation oncologists, because the radiation oncologists, sometimes we'll even bring them into the operating room and say, here's the surgical bed. Here's where we think we're very close. Here's where we think we're in the reactive zone and stuff. Here's where I want you to concentrate your radiation and stuff. So with the role of doing a wider resection, okay, somewhere between a wide and a marginal resection, and the use of adjuvant radiation, we can get that recurrence rate down to 7%, which is very comparable to radical resection and the amputation, plus preserve the patient's ability to function. So this is where the role of radiation comes in, and I'll hand it over to Dr. Mugabe to go over further about that.
Okay, so today I'm going to talk to you guys about the role of radiation, and how does radiation work? So the most common way that we treat with radiation for cancer is with external beam radiation. And the way to think about it is it's kind of like a high-powered X-ray, and it can work both directly and indirectly to damage DNA. The most common mechanism by which it acts is the indirect method, and this is primarily dependent on oxygen molecules neighboring the cancer, and it uses that to help cause damage to the DNA. Now, radiation can be done either externally or internally, known as brachytherapy. External beam radiation is a lot like if you imagine flashlights that you beam on the area you want to treat. Now imagine hundreds of flashlights converging to one area. Where they converge is where it's going to be the hottest or the highest amount of dose, with some neighboring dose in the structures adjacent to it. And that's a lot of times where you'll get your toxicity. External beam radiation can be either given prior to surgery, also known as preoperative radiation, or post-op. And brachytherapy can be given, is perioperative, and can either be done with immediate reconstruction or stage reconstruction, which we'll talk a little bit more about. So, as Dave Johnson talked about, you know, with limb-sparing surgery, to try to help improve quality of life, they did notice an increase in the recurrence rate. So the addition of radiation in different trials have shown that the addition of radiation for both high-grade and low-grade sarcomas improved local control by about 20%. This is a trial for external beam, and here's one from brachytherapy. Now, pre-op versus post-operative radiation. So there is a difference between the two. As I've mentioned before, the primary way radiation works in the external beam setting is by affecting oxygen molecules. So in the pre-operative setting, there's less dose required to get the same amount of efficacy. And this is because in the preoperative setting, the tumor is still well oxygenated, and you only require about 50 gray, which is our unit of radiation measurement, compared to 66, somewhere between 60 and 66 gray in the postoperative setting. And this could lead to potential toxicity benefit, both acute and long term. Now, fewer fractions within the preoperative setting, you require less fractions of radiation. So that's lower cost for the patient, also improved patient convenience, because treatment is primarily daily for weeks on end, somewhere between 5 and 7 weeks. Smaller radiation volume. So in the postoperative setting, anywhere there's surgical manipulation is all at risk of tumor seeding. So we have, as radiation oncologists, postoperatively have to cover those areas, whether it's the incision or the drain site or anywhere that was surgically manipulated. So the volumes get larger. And there's evidence to show that with these larger volumes comes worse long-term sequela. Now, preoperatively, radiation can also potentially cause shrinkage of the tumor and an inflammatory fibrotic encapsulation of the tumor, which can make it, which can improve the ability to get clear margins in the operation. There is some evidence to show that there is an improvement in disease control in the preoperative setting, and a lot of people believe it's because it's easier to identify the areas at risk preoperatively, whereas postoperatively, you don't have gross disease to kind of help guide you. Other explanations include, you know, as we talk about the age of immunotherapy, there is the idea that when you're treating preoperatively and you've got this big, gross disease that you're radiating, there's this rapid cell death, And with cell death, you have a lot of tumor antigens that are presented in the blood, which may help activate the immune response. Although theoretical is one of the thoughts. Now, preoperative does have a detriment, and it's a big one. In the setting, preoperatively, as you guys would imagine, radiation can stunt the growth of rapidly dividing cells. So when done before surgery, there's actually an increased in wound complication rate, almost double. And although it's rare, there is the possibility that when you radiate up front, the tumor could progress through radiation and could potentially make the patient unresectable. Now we're going to talk about brachytherapy. So this is the internal radiation that we were talking about. This starts off with, they have a resection, a wide local excision, and we place catheters spaced apart of roughly a centimeter in the plane of the tumor bed. And one thing I want to note is, IMRT, or intensity modulated radiation therapy, is probably one of the most sophisticated forms of radiation that we deliver. This is the external beam. And as you can see, because you have radiation coming from all different angles, it nicely conforms around the tumor. This is the red here being indicating the hottest area of radiation. But you see that there's kind of dose kind of scattered and sprayed all around, basically all of the normal tissue getting some radiation. With the internal radiation, actually, since the catheters are inserted at the time of surgery, the radiation is delivered from within. So the highest area of dose is right where the tumor was, and you see a rapid drop-off in dose and almost no radiation to normal tissue. So just to kind of go over brachytherapy, because brachytherapy is probably the epitome of a multimodal approach between the surgeon and the radiation oncologist. In the operating room, the surgeon will remove the tumor, and then that's when we come in and we discuss with them the areas that are highest risk of there being microscopic disease, and the surgeons will commonly put surgical clips to kind of aid us in the area of where the tumor was, or even the extent of the resection done. The benefit is that you can directly visualize exactly the area at risk, and the catheters can be positioned to kind of help accommodate that area. The catheters are then positioned in the tumor bed and sewn with absorbable sutures, and they're anchored to the skin with buttons. The two main techniques that are commonly utilized is the immediate reconstruction technique, also known as the traditional technique, where you see these catheters that are placed, and then there's closure placed directly over it, whether it's a flap or a primary closure. Because there's actively healing tissue over the catheters, you have to wait about 5 days so that the radiation doesn't cause wound complications. The other form is staged reconstruction, which uses a temporary wound vac, which acts as a closure, and you can start radiation as soon as the next day without any issues with wound healing. And actually, we have retrospective data from our own institution showing that in patients who've been previously irradiated, it actually improved the wound complication rate. So then we do a CT simulation. That's where we do a CT scan of the area, kind of get a lay of the land. We digitize the catheters, we get an idea of the tumor bed, and you see here the clips are placed in the OR and we're able to digitize them, and that helps guide our treatment. We do radiation planning, and this is where we kind of allow our constraints, we try to meet our constraints and make sure that the volume at risk is covered. And I just want to note here, you see how well this conforms to where the tumor was, and all of the high dose area is right here with no radiation dose to the remaining tissue. So you're able to spare bone, muscle, nerves, joints, etc. Treatment delivery, we have an afterloader, and this has the radiation seed. And this actually feeds the radiation bead through each of these catheters for different varying amounts of time to deliver a nice conformal dose to that area. Toxicities. So historically, with older technologies, radiation was very large, had a high toxicity, very debilitating. You could see that patients would have this lymphedema that would last them a lifetime. And historically, we treated about a 10 centimeter margin on the outside of the tumor. As technology has advanced and as our techniques have advanced, we've actually kind of lowered it to about 5 centimeters in the 90s. And amputation and pathology on amputations actually showed that about 2/3 of patients had microscopic disease outside of where the gross tumor was. And all of that was found within 4 centimeters of the gross disease. So this has kind of guided us as radiation oncologists to ensure that our volumes realistically is just the tumor plus about 4 centimeters. Now, this is just an illustration between preoperative and postoperative. In pre-op radiation, you have gross disease, and this gross disease is, we do expansions about 4 centimeters, and this is the area that we treat. 4 centimeters along the length of the muscle and 1.5 centimeters axially. In the postoperative setting, you have the gross disease, but then you have the entire surgical bed plus the site of incision, and all of that is covered, and then an expansion is done on that. So, toxicity is associated with radiation. The most common being impaired wound healing, especially in the preoperative setting, edema, fibrosis and decreased range of motion, and then less commonly fracture and peripheral nerve injury, and then also secondary malignancy, especially for your younger patients. There's about a 1% per year risk. Now, what do we do to help mitigate some of this toxicity? So, appropriate patient selection. You know, we wouldn't want to do preoperative radiation on a patient who already has a lot of comorbidities for wound complications, such as peripheral vascular disease, diabetes, etc. To mitigate acute toxicity, we could think about using wound vacs, using flaps, or sparing the flap when we're doing our radiation. And then there's also evidence to show that, you know, the time between pre-op radiation and surgery is important, and trying to cut that below 6 to 8 weeks can improve toxicity. Long-term, one of the biggest things for long-term toxicity for a patient is the radiation treatment volumes that that we use. And as you would imagine, the larger the treatment volume, the more normal tissues being treated, and the worse the toxicity. And they actually have evidence showing there's worse fibrosis, joint stiffness, and edema. And what we can do to help improve that is working in concert with our surgeons to get a better idea of the area that needs to be treated, to use, you know, some of the newer techniques like IMRT, and then also reducing the radiation dose. So doses over 60 gray, which would kind of be the post-operative dose, has been associated with pain, edema, decreased range of motion, and fracture.
Just really until the 1970s, our modalities for treatment of metastatic soft tissue sarcomas were surgery and radiation. And we had some systemic therapy by way of dacarbazine, but it really wasn't until the 1970s that we saw some new advances coming. And you can see now, fast forward to today, we have a lot of things to talk about. We have combination therapy. We have some targeted therapies. And it was in 1973 that Italian group, Dr. Belladonna and his colleagues, were studying the use of doxorubicin in many neoplasms. They were looking at lymphomas, breast cancer, sarcomas, and they included included 64 patients who had soft tissue sarcoma. And in this study, these patients received at least 2 doses of doxorubicin, and 21 of those patients, about a third of the patients who received doxorubicin who had soft tissue sarcoma, had a response. Now, if you know anything about Bonadonna and breast cancer, you know that he's pretty well known in that arena. But for sarcoma, he's also known as the father of chemotherapy and sarcoma. And just one interesting thing about adriamycin, or we call doxorubicin, is that it was developed in Italy, and so it's near the Adriatic Sea, and that's how the name adriamycin came to be. So you can see in this timeline, and that's really what I'm going to talk about, is the timeline of development of systemic therapies for this disease. There are these big breaks. So between 1970 and 1980, we had dacarbazine and we had doxorubicin. And then in 1980, Patel and MD Anderson began working on ifosfamide, and it was approved for the treatment of soft tissue sarcomas. Now, between 1980s and 2000 is a big break of 20 years. And during that time, a lot of work was done with combination therapy with adriamycin, ifosfamide, and maybe you all are familiar with the toxicities associated with those, cardiotoxicities, of course, with the adriamycin, and neurotoxicities, cardio and renal toxicities with ifosfamide. And so they were really working at combination therapy, high-dose therapy, and then 1997, Patel and his group began looking at high-dose ifosfamide for soft tissue sarcomas, looking at 14 milligrams per meter squared. And in his research study at that time, they had 74 patients. Half of them were bone sarcomas. The other half were soft tissue sarcomas. And they had 4 complete responders, 17 partial responders. But the bone sarcomas, the osteosarcomas, kind of won out with about 40% response rates and 20% response rate for soft tissue sarcomas. So you can really see there were some struggles with this very rare type of cancer through those 20 years until we saw a breakthrough in targeted therapy with a drug called imatinib. You all may know it, of course, with in treatment of CLL. Gastrointestinal stromal tumors were originally thought to derive from smooth muscle, and they were considered part of the leiomyosarcoma family. However, as time went on, they were studied, and they were showing some ultrastructural evidence of autonomic neural differentiation. And now they are thought to originate from interstitial cells of Kajal, or at least differentiate into them because they express c-kit and or cd34, and this is the key. This was the key that kind of unlocked our thinking for sarcomas, and we began to think, what is happening genetically with these tumors? Where can we block the cell differentiation to stop tumor growth? So we found that about 70 to 80% of GIST express KIT, and 70% of that expression is exon 11, but you can see the other expressions here. They also express PDGFRA-alpha and in about 5 to 7% of the time. But we do have wild-type GIST as well. 10 to 15% of patients have wild-type GIST. So imatinib came on the forefront in 2002, big breakthrough, approved for adjuvant therapy for locally advanced, unresectable, and metastatic GIST. Dimitri and his colleagues in 2002 looked at the efficacy and safety of imatinib in doses of 400 milligrams and 600 milligrams, and they found about a 54% partial response, 41% stable disease. And what's really exciting is that for the first time in the treatment of a soft tissue sarcoma, we saw median survivals that were very meaningful, 9 to 12 months. So toxicities. I was saying it would be great to have a talk, just an hour, on these therapies and talk about them. But because I think many of you are familiar with imatinib, you might know peripheral edema, facial edema, periorbital edema. We have our patients take and give them some counseling about low-salt diet, making sure they're very well hydrated, and compression stockings, elevating their extremities. And then sometimes we use diuretics, but we find really that it's difficult to control this, and it leads to weight gain, which is very troubling for patients. And usually I do look at their thyroid function, and for men, I'll look at their testosterone. But beyond that, sometimes I have to refer them to endocrine for a workup of weight gain, and usually it just is chalked up to the extra fluid accumulation that they have. I have this one patient who tries very hard to maintain her weight, but with the fluid accumulation on Gleevec, she's not able to. And she's been on Gleevec for 3 years after resection without any evidence of recurrence of her disease. And then, of course, the Gleevec has nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, weight loss, sometimes some unexplained abdominal pain. And then I didn't include slides on sunitinib and regorafenib, which are second and third line for patients who develop resistance to imatinib. So after 2007, we have another break of time. 2002, 10 years forward till we find a novel therapy with pazopanib. And then also trabectedin, eribulin, 2015, and then olaratumab in late 2016. Pazopanib is a multi-tyrosine kinase inhibitor. It's FDA indicated for patients with advanced soft tissue sarcoma having previously received sarcoma. European study showed that these patients had a median progression-free survival of 4.6 months and for pazopanib and 1.6 months for placebo. And then the overall survival rate for patients on pazopanib was 12.5 and placebo was 10.7. And you can see in the research study, these patients had fatigue, a fair amount of fatigue, diarrhea, nausea, weight loss. I always say we should market this for weight loss, but I don't think we'd have any takers because it's so toxic. Also hypopigmentation, so patients do, we counsel them, they don't lose their hair, but they do have their hair turn very brightly white gray. Hypertension and cardiovascular disorders are prevalent with this drug. We ask patients to take their blood pressure once a day and keep a log. If it gets above 140 over 90, to give us a call. We start conservatively depending on the blood pressure readings with a diuretic hydrochlorothiazide or we'll add an ACE inhibitor. Sometimes if that's not working, I'll switch to Norvasc. But beyond that, sometimes I do refer out to our cardiologist. We have an oncology cardiologist right in our clinic, and I have a full workup. And it's always very important to help them mitigate and control their underlying cardiovascular disease if they have that as a comorbidity as well. The GI toxicities of this can be very troubling for patients, hand-foot syndrome as well. Pazopanib is given in 200 milligram tablets. In renal cell carcinoma, the typical dose is 800 milligrams a day, and it's fairly well tolerated. And for some unknown reason that we're not sure of, 800 milligrams is rarely tolerated in patients with soft tissue sarcoma. Generally, we start with 200 milligrams or 400 milligrams and titrate up every 2 to 4 weeks by 200 milligrams. We usually get to about 600 milligrams. In the time that I've been working in sarcoma, I have one patient who's been able to tolerate long-term 800 milligrams of pazopanib. And then trabectedin came on the scene in 2015. It's an alkylating agent that bends the DNA helix via the groove guanine. It perturbs the cell cycle and gets it pretty aggravated and leads to cell death. The indications are for unresectable metastatic liposarcoma or leiomyosarcoma in patients who have previously had doxorubicin or an anthracycline-containing regimen. It's given by a 24-hour infusion CAD pump. Patients come in and they have infusion visit, they get hooked up to their pump, and they come back 24 hours later. They get unhooked, and they receive Neulasta. Dimitri and his colleagues in 2016 published a study of 518 patients, and the final results show that trabectedin resulted in a 45% reduction of risk of disease progression, and the take-home was that it was superior to dacarbazine in terms of disease control. Toxicities are nausea, chemotherapy-induced nausea. If you don't work very hard at controlling it for the first dose, patients get a learned response, and then it's very difficult for subsequent doses. I think there's some experience with this drug and other cancer types, and we've borrowed from that, and our patients receive Aloxi plus steroids on day one, and then when they're unhooked, they get Emend. And with that type of regimen and aggressive control of their nausea, we have good success. And, of course, and then they have Combazine and nausea going home. What's different about this drug is we have to watch carefully for rhabdomyolysis. So along with your studies that you look at prior to chemo, you have to draw a CK level. Next novel therapy, 2015 was a big year for soft tissue sarcomas, is Arubulin. It's another marine animal. It is a derived from a sponge. It is FDA indicated for metastatic liposarcoma previously treated with anthracycline-based regimen. These have pretty short infusion times, about 15 minutes in the infusion for the actual infusion, maybe only a couple hours up in the infusion center. and Schofsky in 2016 and his colleagues published. And this really is important because this was the first randomized phase 3 trial of a single agent systemic therapy with an active control to show significant improvement in overall survival. So we were pretty excited about Arubulin, the overall survival overall across both types of sarcoma was 13.5 months for Arubulin and 11.5 for dacarbazine. Progression-free survival was similar at 2.6 months. But the winner here was liposarcoma. As you can see that the overall survival for liposarcoma was 15.6 months versus 8.4 in the dacarbazine group. Pretty well tolerated. I have a patient who is probably on cycle 12 now with liposarcoma, very good quality of life, plays golf every day with his buddies. So we have to look out for the neutropenia and constipation with this drug. And then 2016, we all got excited about olaratumab in combination with doxorubicin. It's a monoclonal antibody. It's FDA breakthrough designation for soft tissue sarcoma. Tapp and his colleagues published a study with demonstrated progression-free survival with the combination of doxorubicin and olaratumab of 6.6 months versus doxorubicin alone, 4.1 months. But the big news here is the overall survival was moved. This is the first time we saw a big advance in overall survival for these patients. You know, that just means more birthdays, more anniversaries, more graduations. Very exciting news for us in soft tissue sarcoma work. But the overall survival for the combination was 26.5 months versus 14.7 months in the single agent doxorubicin. What we learned is that the combination therapy really doesn't have any new or different side effects, except with we think that headache is more prevalent in the combination, and that neutropenia can be more severe and prolonged with the combination, but we don't see an increase in neutropenic fever. So you may have a few more delays in treatment, but you don't have the neutropenic fever component. So where do we go from here? You know, when you think about my timeline, you see these big breaks. We see 10 years, 12 years, you know, 20 years in between. Let's just hope that since we started in 2012, we're on a roll. And there are now clinical trials for sarcoma that involve vaccines. We're looking at immunotherapy. We're doing intratumoral immunotherapy injections. We are looking at CAR T cell therapy, and we're looking at tyrosine kinase inhibitors in combination with other targeted therapy and investigational agents. So let's hope that the long desert is you know, behind us. So thank you.
So, you know, just to kind of tie it all together, the surveillance for these patients by the NCCN guidelines based primarily on separated by low-grade tumors and high-grade, so it's kind of based on the risk. And as Dave talked about earlier, the two areas that sarcomas commonly recur are locally and distantly, and the most likely place for distant recurrence is in the lung. So the imaging that we do is to look at local recurrence and distance. So for low-grade tumors, local imaging is about 3 to 6 months for about 2 to 3 years, then annually. And you can change this based on their local recurrence risk. So patients who have positive margins or multifocal disease or recurrent disease, you may want to have them more frequently. In high-grade cancers, you would want to go more 3 to 4 months for 2 years, then 6 months for 2 years, then annually. Again, you can adjust it based on their risk of recurrence. And then for chest imaging, for low-grade, probably every 6 to 12 months would be adequate, but for high grade, 3 to 6 months for the first 2 to 3 years, 6 months for 2 years, then annually. So multidisciplinary care. So here we kind of talk about, you know, the multidisciplinary management between radiation and surgery. So this really working together can help improve the patient's toxicity and quality of life. Some of the key features, just to highlight again, is working with the surgeon to localize exactly where the tumor is, and discuss the areas that are at highest risk. This will allow us to use more concise treatment volumes, which can lower their long-term toxicity, but then also can help improve disease control, especially when trying to resect in areas that are difficult to obtain clear margins, such as abutting neurovascular bundles and in retroperitoneal sarcomas. Now, working with the medical oncologist, you know, it's important that the radiation oncology and medical oncology work together, especially evaluating appropriate overlap in care and managing hematologic issues. And at the end of the day, it's patient-centric care. We have multidisciplinary tumor boards to talk about the different treatment options that are available between the surgeon, the radiation oncology team, and the medical oncology team. But then at the end of the day, it's for us to bring these options to the patient and to kind of evaluate the patient's personal goals. What is it that they want out of their treatment? And coordinate toxicity care and follow-up between specialties. So to summarize, there's varied groups of tumors. When for high grades, these are more your large, deep, fixed, heterogeneous tumors with necrosis. And the treatment for these is a multimodality approach, including surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation. And surveillance, want to look for local recurrence and distant recurrence, and you adjust the frequency depending on their risk of recurrence. I just want to, you know, thank the entire sarcoma team, Dave and Princess Leia and the entire group. Thank you.
Great team. So we have it looks like we have about 5 minutes for a Q&A session. If anybody has any questions, please shout them up to us. Yes.
When you talked about the Laratumab, no allergic reactions? Because we have a ton.
Have you had allergic reactions?
Like horrible, severe.
We prophylax with steroids
and
Benadryl
too.
Prior.
Yeah, I think and I just wanted to say it because you may not be in the same region, and I think it's regionally just like it is with cetuximab, and
yes.
I live in a region. So if you live in a region where cetuximab's bad, you may have the same problem with this.
Yeah.
I mean, we've had to literally call our rapid response for people who've died and then got back. I mean, they came back, but they're bad reactions.
Right. They are very dramatic when they occur, and we have not seen that many of them because we prophylaxed prior, but we do have our rapid response team ready to go if that happens.
We prophylax significantly before and still have it.
Still having them.
Yeah, I think it's, again, just that there must be an area that this works in. That was one of our physicians thought that was same as what you see with cetuximab. So.
Interesting.
Very good. Interesting.
Very interesting.
Hello. Hi. I was wondering, you were discussing the dramatic increase in overall survival with olaratumab, and I'm wondering, is that recommended first line, or are there therapies that they have to fail before they can get that?
No. So in the research study, patients received up to 8 cycles of combination with doxorubicin and olaratumab, and then after, they went on maintenance. And in the research study, they did day 1, day 8, olaratumab off. After they had completed their doxorubicin component. But many of our patients come to us with already anthracycline exposure, so we have to look very carefully at their cumulative dose of radiation. We may not be able to get those 8 doses in, so sometimes we're happy if we get 2 doxorubicin olaratumab to 4 and then put them on maintenance therapy, olaratumab after that.
You mentioned in the initial staging imaging component of their care, CT scans of the chest, abdomen, and pelvis versus an MRI. Is there any role for a PET scan as part of that initial staging?
That's a very good question.
So, PET scan is mostly currently is for investigational use only.
Yeah.
There are some studies to suggest that you can use PET in radiomics to help predict for outcome, but not as a common, it's not commonly used, to answer your question.
Thank you.
Hi, so in breast cancer, they do needle localization with MRI. Is there any role, you were talking about the extent of edema around the tumor. Can you mark it so that surgically you're a little more accurate, or is the imaging just not there?
Yeah, so what we do is in combination with our radiation oncologist, we'll bring Dr. Nagavi into the operating room and show him where that reactive zone is, okay? And then we actually use tissue clips, okay, to mark that surrounding area. So not only can they can see it when they kind of simulate the patient at the end for the radiation, they can kind of see where our borders were, but they can actually, I bring him into the operating room so he can actually see where we want to concentrate that radiation to the fullest extent. So it is that team approach. With the, it's interesting when you talk about the edema and stuff. So obviously when a cancer first presents, there's a lot of surrounding edema to it and stuff. If we happen to do pre-op radiation to it, okay, or they might have chemotherapy preoperatively and stuff, some of that edema, obviously, if we get a good response, will go away. So when we talk about our surgical resections, we actually try to go back to the original imaging and stuff and kind of look at where that edema was and stuff so we could kind of be outside that because interoperatively, we're not going to be able to see that at this point. So,
yeah. And with the preoperative radiation, it's not a dose that's high enough to eradicate gross disease, but it's actually very good for microscopic disease. So it does a pretty good job of sterilizing the area where the edema is, and it becomes, the surgical resection required does not become nearly as large.
All right, team, I think that does it for today and stuff. We're available afterwards if you need to.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
This concludes this podcast from the 2017 JabPro Live at AppShow Conference. To view the presentation material, see other topics of interest, and learn how to earn credit for these activities, please visit advancedpractitioner.com/sessions2017.